About that? No. But Kyle could fix it. All right. So this is the book, if ever you're interested, by Ian Murray. And so tonight, because this is the next chapter, we're looking at a fellow by the name of Thomas Charles of Bala. How many know that name? I have to confess to you that when I saw that that was the next chapter, I didn't know about the name either. In fact, when George Sunday said, "This is who we're speaking," he looked at me like, "Who's this?" And at that point, my thinking was along the same lines. Now, I found out later, I actually have heard some of his story before, but I certainly wouldn't remember the name. But it's interesting to me that Ian Murray, a very significant Christian biographer, puts this in a short book of heroes. And so we're going to look at him tonight. There are his dates, 1755 to 1814. So as I start looking at those dates, some of the things that strike me, of course, he crosses a century line. That's interesting. But also, that tells me he's a little after the time of the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening is the dates, I think the date 1740. Right around there is when Whitfield comes to America. And so that's the time of what's called the Great Awakening. Sometimes it's called the Methodist Awakening or the Evangelical Awakening. And so, but he's born 15 years after that. Here he is at a younger age. Interestingly, both born and died in October. He's from Bala, which is where? Okay, that's where Thomas Charles is from. He's from Wales, okay? And so I have to help. Now, we're Americans, and so geography gets a little funny. Being Texans, it gets a real funny because, like, it's like, what, you know, once you leave Texas, who cares, right? And so Texan Americans really have a problem with maps. And so here's a little help. This is Great Britain, okay? And so the British Isles, we call them that because they are islands. Uh-huh, that's good. So here's Ireland, okay? Here's Scotland. And here is England. On the left, or we might call it the west of England, we find a place called Wales, okay? Please be careful not to put an H in that word. And perhaps you've heard of the town Cardiff, the Welsh town Cardiff. Well, here's another look at it. Here's Wales, okay? So there we see a few more of the cities of Wales, like Cardigan and other areas like that. You get a picture of it. Well, let me narrow in on this a little bit more. Our hero, Thomas Charles, was born in this region, Carmarthen, I guess you would pronounce that. Let me just straight up tell you that in Wales, the phonetic rules go out the window. Okay, they had a law early on, I think it was in 1100 or something, that banished vowels from the nation of Wales. There's all these words with no vowels, and it's just really bizarre. Now, the law is not true, but you'll see some of that later on. But anyway, that's where that region there is where he's born and raised, our hero, Mr. Charles. But he's called Thomas Charles of Bala, and so there's Bala up there. It's a small little town in the northern part of Wales. And so there you see the two of them on that map, and just get a little perspective of how far they are apart and what's going on. So again, we need a little help. We don't know, probably most of you, if I would say, what do you know about Wales? You'd probably be talking about the things that spout, and that sort of thing. What do you know about the country? As Americans, we're often ignorant. And so now we've given you something of a map, given you a little perspective where it is compared to Britain, in the England, Scotland, Ireland. And now we're going to look at just some leading English Methodists of his, or Welsh Methodists of the time. So who's the founder, would we normally think, of Methodism? When we think of the Methodists, we think of whom? Wesley brothers, John Wesley in particular, the older brother of two. Charles, you know, he was more the theologian, preacher. Charles was the musician. And we've sung a lot more of Charles Methodist songs, Charles Wesley's songs, than we've read John Wesley's sermons. So if you want to have a lasting impact, sing, write songs rather than sermons. But the Welsh Methodists are a branch of the Methodists that were located in Wales. Okay? So that helps us. So there was a tremendous moving of the, what we call the Methodist Revival or the Evangelical Revival at that time. Let me explain, matter of fact, when we're talking about the Evangelical Revival at that time, George Whitefield really liked, that was one of the labels he used, Evangelical. Sometimes it was almost interchangeable with Methodists in this time frame and this group of people. They were called Methodists as a slur from the club that was at the Holy Club at Oxford that Wesley, ran. And everybody talked about how methodical they were in their Christianity. And so they mocked them for it. But eventually, the Methodists embraced the title, kind of like Christians. It was a mockery that Christians eventually adopted. They're also called evangelicals. That's a label that goes back to, Whitefield liked that term, but it goes back to really Martin Luther. And basically, if you look at the word evangelical, you see in it the word evangel, which is the Greek word euangelion, which means the good news. The evangel means the gospel. And so evangelicals were those who were gospel Christians, as opposed to ritual Christians. So in the Church of England, and they didn't call themselves ritual Christians, but in other words, I would call them that. Are you a Christian? Of course I'm a Christian. Why do you think you're a Christian? Because my name is on the baptism records of my church. I was born to parents who were members of that church, and their parents were members of the church, and their parents, every one of us has been baptized. I'm a Christian. Do you go to church? Well, yeah, I do sometimes. So I'm a Christian. But the main thing is some water hit my head when I was at a very young age. I don't really recall, but my name was written in the record, and I have the record. That's a Christian. Evangelicals are saying, well, there needs to be a gospel in there, that you are a sinner who has sought grace from the sovereign Lord, and he's saved you and forgiven you based on what Christ did on the cross. So that's the evangel in a nutshell. Evangelicals preach that. Remember we talked about George Whitefield was basically banished from Church of England pulpits because he took the outlandish view that ministers should be born again. So those are the labels we'll kind of use interchangeably. Here were some leading Welsh Methodists. Can I throw another label at you? Calvinistic Methodists. The Methodists of Wales were Calvinistic, as opposed to the Methodists like Wesley was an Arminian. George Whitefield was a Calvinist, and so that led to conflict between the Wesleys really went after him for that. The Methodists of Wales were Calvinistic. That's just a historical fact. I always think that's odd, because when I think Methodist, I think Arminian. And so it's like Calvinistic, Methodist, those two terms shouldn't be together. But it is. Here are some leading ones. Daniel Rowland, William Williams. I always think what an interesting name to name your child when your last name's Williams. William Williams, Howell Harris, and these were all in the southern part of Wales. William Williams was a great hymn writer. He's written some over 800 hymns in Welsh and over 100 that are in English. And our familiar one, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. He wrote that one, but he didn't. That's not how he titled it. He titled it the first part. And that's not abbreviated, okay? CWM is a word, okay? I don't know what that word means, but we'll look at this later. Howell Harris was non-ordained. Back then, you couldn't preach if you weren't ordained. So he was an exhorter. And for that reason, he wasn't allowed into the pulpit to preach. So he exhorted in homes and in the open fields. And it was he who influenced Whitfield. Hey, this open-air preaching works. So they corresponded. Whitfield tried it and said, this is God's call. Because he was more and more pulpits were being closed to Whitfield. Okay, so Howell Harris was very influential in Whitfield's life. And Daniel Rowland is a spiritual hero in Wales for his influence for the gospel. In the north, there was very little open, you know, it was Church of England, very little openness to the Methodists. In fact, when Howell Harris went up and preached in 1741, that's Whitfield's time. That's when Whitfield's in America preaching. He went up to the northern part of Wales and preached the gospel. The mob nearly killed him. Okay? And one who trusted Christ at that time was a lady by the name of Jane Jones. I'm really struck by the simplicity of these names, William Williams, Jane Jones, but their language is not simple. So I thought we'd talk for a minute about it. Kind of take a tangent here. That's just to remind some of you, you're going back to school and you'll be taking math. So I'm going to take a little tangent here and look at this song. I want you to just hear it. Let me get my volume nice and high enough. I don't know if that's doing it or not. There we go. I want you to hear this and watch it. Okay, watch the words. So at least you can hear what Wales looks like. And are you getting that? Is it coming through? Is that working through the speaker? Nope. Was that you? That was coming off of here. Can I reconnect? I would like to reconnect. In Welsh. Really? There you go. It's not showing me that there's anything to connect to. Oh, wait a minute. No. And they invented grape juice. Try again. All right. Okay, it's supposed to be looking good. Let's try it. So you're going to actually see it. This hymn is so popular with the Welsh that I've seen it called the unofficial national anthem. In other words, it's not the national anthem of Wales, but it occurred to me it's kind of like we have a national anthem, but a lot of people almost would sing more boldly, God Bless America. Or if I were to say there's a hymn of America, what would it be? America Beautiful, or really Amazing Grace. That comes to my mind. So this, and the Welsh people are a singing people. Over the years, I remember, hearing about the coal miners of Wales who just sing in the streets. They're known as a people who sing. So that's, you saw that. And so I want to give you another illustration of the popularity of it. Here's the 1999 Rugby World Cup. Rugby is kind of like football, or maybe the British would say football is kind of like rugby. But But here's the World Cup, a big event, and it was being held in Wales. And so in the midst of this, you'll hear them say that they're going to sing this song. There were all these gathered choirs as well as the 72,000 people all singing this song in English. And one of the things you'll hear, the singer, who's a famous actor and musician there, he'll say, "Show them we are a singing nation." Okay, so I'm just going to let you hear a clip of it.
A star on Broadway in the west end of London, Michael Ball, leading the massed choirs in one of the great Welsh hymns, Cwm Rhondda, Bread of Heaven.
You hear how it's pronounced, Cwm Rhondda.
This should receive a tumultuous response from this 72,500 fans. Cwm Rhondda with Michael Ball.
Let's show that we are a nation of song.
You get the feel, you know, in other words, it's a singing people, and this is a popular song, going back to right the time of Thomas Charles. It's written by William Williams. Can I give you just one last illustration that's not musical? You know this couple? Well, their names are right there. Prince William and Kate. This was sung at their wedding. Now, why would it have been sung? I think How Great Thou Art was, too. They had some great music. Why was it sung at their wedding? Prince of Wales. And so this is actually, I snatched this off of YouTube right while they're singing it. So frankly, the service wasn't as tumultuous, to use the another announcer, in his singing of this hymn. But in other words, this is the Welsh. If you're the Prince of Wales, good idea to have Cwm Rhondda in the service. So just to show you, in other words, this period in history still has an influence in Wales, diminishing, but there are certain things about it that keep. Back to Thomas Charles. So he was born in that little area we talked about in the southern part of Wales. He came to faith when he was 18 years old. And so here's from, I guess, his diary. On January 20th, 1773, 3 years before our nation starts, 30 years after Whitfield is at his prime in America, I went to hear Mr. Rowland. Remember we talked about him? One of the Daniel Rowland, one of the great evangelists of Wales. I heard him preach at New Chapel. His text was Hebrews what? 4:15. Okay, we're seeing if you know those Roman numerals. See, Reba's still getting used to the ones we use. This is how she started. A day much to be remembered by me as long as I live. Ever since that happy day, I have lived in a new heaven and a new earth. The change which a blind man who receives his sight experiences does not exceed the change which at that time I experienced in my mind. So he was born again, he says, on this day. And just the world became a new world to him through the gospel. Okay, and so he came to faith. Probably raised in a pretty humble home. Studied at Oxford. And here's another influence in his life. So we saw Roland, and now we see, have you ever heard of John Newton from Olney? Okay, we have. We know that name, right? And so after, you know, as part of his young training, his training for ministry at Oxford to be an Anglican minister, he went and spent a summer with Newton. In the year 1777, I spent the summer vacation with Mr. Newton at Olney. This visit proved very comfortable and very profitable indeed. Having a Newton to be instructed by, both by edifying discourses in the pulpit and by conversation in the closet, in other words, personal conversation, it's not that they met in the closet to converse, what place or situation can I be in more pleasing and delightful? I formed in my mind great ideas of him, but really he has exceeded my most sanguine expectations. So, you know, so his point is, this was a transforming summer for him, a young minister, and that was one of the influences of John Newton. You know, whether it be mentoring people like a William Wilberforce or these young future pastors that would come and spend time with him, he built into their lives, and it was transforming. Well, he was ordained in 1778, so that's during right after his time with Newton. He finishes his training. He's ordained at Oxford University as a deacon in the church. He became ordained as a priest in the church in 1780. He served as a minister in a variety of churches and basically failed in every one of them, not because he failed, but because they didn't like that gospel message. Matter of fact, during that time, he wrote a letter to someone saying, so-and-so, a good friend and all this, has been, you know, basically kicked out of the university, will not get a degree because of his Methodist leanings. So even though, in a sense, Methodism starts at Oxford, they are pressing it. And so, and the Church of England, there's more and more closed. And so he goes from church, you know, try to get into a church. He'd be maybe 2 weeks, and they'd say, get out of here. We don't want you. And so it became kind of a frustrating experience for him. Also in 1778, he went with a friend to Northern Wales. And while he was there, he went up to Bala. And there he met Sally Jones. You've already heard the name Mary Jones, or was it Jane Jones? Jane Jones, her mother, who got saved under Howell Harris's ministry. And so he went up, and you know, they traveled up there. But it seems historically probably a major reason for going to Northern Wales was to meet Sally. She was known for her attractiveness and her godliness. And so they visited, and this is a picture of the shop that belonged to her family. And eventually, you know, it was her shop, and they lived there and then next door for a while. That's where he probably met and conversed with her. After a while, not immediately, right afterwards, he texted her or something. He wrote her a letter, and I like the way he said it. You know, it's been a while, and they've only had that one little bit period of meeting. My very dear friend. Kind of bold. And then he even says, such an unexpected address from a person who never saw you but once, and that at such a long interval of time, I will at first not a little surprise you. Okay, in other words, he starts off with rather bold writing and saying, yep, we met once. It's been a while since we've had any contact, and I'm starting off with my very dear friend. Well, at first, she was not real responsive. It took about 3.5 years to reach the goal of August 20. So tomorrow will be the one of their anniversaries of being married at that church. I do not know how you pronounce that church. But they're in Bala. Well, part of the thing of getting him to marry her was a problem with the parents. He explained it this way in a letter to a friend. She's an only child of tender and affectionate parents. It would be worse than death for her to be removed whilst they live to a considerable distance. I would not for the world be the means of bringing their gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. They basically said, she's not marrying you if you're taking her down south. She's got, you know, she's all we have. You're staying close if you're marrying our daughter. And he consented to that. They moved to Bala. But no church, well, the southern churches were kind of closed to him anyway. I mean, he had friends like John Newton plugging for him and others. But he moved north, but no Church of England would have him because he preached the gospel. He did go and preach at a friend's church, an evangelical Anglican. And here's his report of how it turned out. Last Sunday, the whole parish, with two or three of the principal inhabitants at their head, came and accosted me in a rougher strain than I have ever been used to before. Now, he's already been fired from several churches for preaching the gospel. Now, a committee comes with some leading guys, and they led into him. They insisted on my preaching no more in their church, for they added, quote, you have cursed us enough already. That's kind of bold. I took care that nothing but the plain, simple truth should give offense. So he said, I was careful to basically only give them scripture, so they're offended at scripture. But they're saying, it's a curse to hear you preach the Bible to us. Out, out, out. And so I think it was 2 weeks, and then that door was closed because his friend had been ill, and so he was filling in for him. So church committee meets and are pretty bold with him. So he was really wrestling with, maybe I need to not be in the ministry. I've got this wife to care for and support. No church will have me. Newton, among others, were saying, don't give up on the church. So here's what how he's feeling about the whole thing. He writes to a friend, I feel myself much inclined to take Wales as I did my wife, for better, for worse, till death do us part. In other words, I'm committed. I'm here. I'm in Wales. Whatever it might be, easy or hard, pleasant or not, I'm here in Wales. So he worked or he prayed. He's got a family to provide for his wife. And so he starts working in the shop as well and really wrestling with, what do I do? Though Sally's father was a lay preacher in the Methodist fellowships, there were about a half dozen Methodist groups in Northern Wales. Charles had never even been to one of their meetings. So that's how much he was committed to the Church of England way, though he was a gospel preacher. But as a gospel preacher, he didn't fit with the Church of England, at least that he knew of. And so there was this tension, but he never visited, because those Methodists, well, let's face it, I mean, they're a bunch of wackos. Kind of reminds me when early on here, I had surgery, and the pain medicine wasn't working for me. Put in a call to our physician, and he sent out a stronger pain medicine. And the pharmacist told Barb, now, the doctor here says you can take two of these pills at a time. He said, but I'd start with one. If he takes two, he'll be preaching like a Methodist. So he didn't, these Methodists had a reputation. But in 1784, he visits the assembly, and before you know it, he's preaching for them and being warmly received. Okay. 1785, he said, I'm just this moment come home from 3 weeks' tour through that area there and with the other one. And the fields here are all over the country are white for the harvest. Now, was it snowing, or what was he talking about? John, right, where Jesus said, the fields are white for the harvest, pray for laborers. He said, the fields are white. I'm a laborer. Fresh ground is daily gained. So it's every day the gospel is growing in this region. Whole neighborhoods where the word has been heretofore opposed call aloud for the gospel. This must have been so exciting. One door after another slammed in his face. Now he's preaching, and they're saying, more, more, more. Thousands, and this is Wales. There's not that many people there. Thousands flock to here, and many in different parts of the country, we have good reason to believe, are effectually called. He says, I'm convinced there is genuine salvation going on here. This, what a change from out 2 weeks, we've had enough of you cursing us, to calls, please, please, more, more, expanse, growth. What an exciting turn of events. Well, his approach to ministry then expands in a kind of an interesting way. He was awestruck. He's an Oxford boy at how illiterate and uneducated the people were. He writes, when I came a little acquainted with the country, I was surprised and grieved to find so many totally illiterate and not able to read a word in the Bible in their mother's tongue. Welsh, of course. Already we've got a blending of languages. But here these people are Welsh, and they can't read it, the Bible, in their heart language. I have attempted and succeeded far beyond my expectation in setting up charity schools with a view only to teaching poor children and young people to read the Bible in a language they understand and teach them the principles of the Christian religion by catechizing them. We had 7 schoolmasters last year in employ, and we think of increasing the number to 12 this ensuing summer. I visit all the schools myself as often as I can. So he started by teaching in his own home, this the kids right in the neighborhood. It was fruitful. He was gifted in that area, effective with these, loved kids, saw the fruit. Next thing you know, he's got 7 teachers in his employ, and then he's moving up to 12. They would go into a region for 9 months. He said, that's about all we can do. Get them literate and then move on. Now again, it can't be that hard. There's no vowels. So they just go in, teach them how to read consonants, and move on. But in other words, the focus was, if you're illiterate, how much are you going to get out of the Bible for yourself? And so this is one of the struggles we have in missions today, is when you go into a society that doesn't have a literature, a written literature. What do we do? And so you often see them carefully learning the language, sometimes creating an alphabet, putting it into writing, teaching them to read. Another approach has been giving them audio Bibles. And since, you know, hey, it's an audio society where they are, then let's give it to them, oral traditions. But that's the struggle. If you're illiterate, how can you benefit from the scriptures? Well, here's just a report that he writes in December 7th of 1791. So we're 5, 6, 7 years after the last reports. And he says, here in our town of Baylor for some time back, we've had a great, powerful, and glorious outpouring of the Spirit of our God and the people in general, and especially young people. Revival has hit Baylor. The state and welfare of the soul has become the general concern of the country. So everybody's talking about how are you spiritually? And Baylor, this little place that wouldn't talk, where there was a riot when Howell Harris preached and they tried to kill him. Now everyone's talking, how are you doing spiritually? Some of the wildest and most inconsiderate of the people have been awakened. This glorious work began on a Sunday afternoon in the chapel where I preached twice that day. Cannot say there was anything particular in the ministry of that day more than what I had often experienced among our people. But towards the close of the evening service, the Spirit of God seemed to work in a powerful manner. So he said, here was a typical Sunday. I was preaching like I always do, but there was a response to the gospel that I can't explain. See, that's true revival is not next August for 1 week we will have more meetings. Or some people, if it's real revival, we'll have all-night meetings. We'll have all-night prayer, you know. He didn't schedule anything. He just preached. But God, the Holy Spirit, poured out. And even the wildest of people, the young people, responding to the gospel in a powerful way. So the whole community is really struck by it. That's revival. It's a sovereign work of the Holy Spirit. So he was involved in bringing the gospel in a powerful way to Northern Wales. He was involved in bringing education to Northern Wales. Further, he was an author. He wrote a Welsh catechism. He wrote this other book that we would entitle, or he started publishing a quarterly spiritual magazine entitled The Spiritual Treasury. Look at those words. Like I said, I don't even know how to begin pronouncing that. Okay. In 1809, a life work, his greatest work of all, was what he called a scriptural dictionary. It was this massive work that just, you know, it explained terms, was theological and biblical, of great resource. Bibles were very rare at this time in Welsh. Hard to get a hold of. By the way, here is his catechism. It looks like you got your fingers on the wrong keys when you started typing. You know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't make fun of our Welsh people, but anyway, it's a tough language and very interesting. Like I said, Bibles were very rare, and this was a struggle. So this is where I heard of Thomas Charles before. Because one day, there at the church or at his home, I've heard it both said, that a young lady, 16 years old, walked 30 miles barefooted because she had worked hard enough so she could save up the money to buy a Bible. So she walked 30 miles barefooted across Northern Wales to buy a Bible. And there's a later picture of what she might have looked like. Here's a map. If you remember, this is kind of a challenging area that they were in, from her region over to Baylor. I don't know. I think Jones must be a popular name. This is in a museum in Wales. It says, I bought this in her own handwriting in English. It says, I bought this in the 16th year of my age. I'm a daughter of Jacob Jones and Mary Jones, his wife. The Lord gave me grace. Amen. Mary Jones, he is the true owner of this Bible. Bought in the year 1800, age 16. So this became famous because Mary walked all that distance to buy a Bible and then walked home. What does that tell you about a hunger for a Bible? Sometimes we're not willing to walk across the room to pick up a Bible. But she was so hungry for God's word And so there was a, you know, a story that was written all about her and her life, and she was a remarkable young lady who grew up. She was a woman of poverty. At the end of her life, she was blind. She didn't make, matter of fact, in her older years, she raised bees as a way of an income. She would sell the honey to live on. She would sell the beeswax, which was much more precious, and take the proceeds from that and split it between Bible society and missionary work. So, but in other words, Mary Jones is a famous figure in Welsh history. Just she's one of those stories that kind of like we know various stories of George Washington, you know, crossing the Delaware and all those, you know, those stories. This is a story in Welsh history. Well, she came for a Bible, and fortunately, and I think it may have been his last one. He had a Bible for her. Other people came if they could afford it. He didn't have the Bibles, and it was, and so he contacted the SPCK, the Society for the Propagation or Promulgation or whatever of Christian Knowledge in England. And he, you know, said, please send us Bibles. Well, they didn't have any Bibles. He said, print more. And they said, we will. And they didn't. So finally, he started pushing for what we need is a Bible society. Well, in 1804, with him being one of the major push influences, they actually established the British and Foreign Bible Society. And in 1806, the first Welsh Bible was published by them. Now, there had already been a translation into Welsh in the 1500s, but they just weren't being printed and available for the people. So even if they were illiterate, they couldn't get a hold of a Bible. Well, here's the first New Testament published by the that new Bible society. I get the word testament. I can kind of see new, and from there it gets a little tricky. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they are long and challenging. So this is where he becomes profoundly influential, in that he brought the gospel in a huge way to North Wales. He brought education in a very substantial way to North Wales. He brought printed materials. And so he was a publisher of he started a magazine. He is this huge dictionary. He, you know, this catechism. You know, so he was creating literature for the people of Wales in their language. Well, he saw, well, there's a need for Bibles. Well, I guess we need to start a Bible society. And like I said, Mary Jones was just one, all kinds of people, rich and poor, you know, tried to invest in it so the Bibles could be available at home and abroad. This is the church where he ministered. And there's a statue of him in front of it to this day. It's interesting to me. We don't know anything about this man here in America, here in Texas. You know, we barely, you know, he's not a known name. But Ian Murray is a little more alert to such things. And so he knows that this is a name that needs to be honored as one of the heroes of the faith. A guy who went into an area. I mean, just think of his ministry, how many people after that many closed doors, church after church after church in southern Wales, northern Wales the same, at what point do you just say, never mind, my wife's family has a shop, we can work there, and we'll be comfortable. But he was willing to seek the Lord and follow the Lord and preach wherever, and God used that in a mighty way so that revival came to North Wales. And scriptures came to North Wales. Here's a quote from him, of just in his own life. I find it daily indispensably necessary to have a clear apprehension of the eternity, unchangeableness, freeness, and independency of God's love to enable me to walk forward with any degree of confidence and comfort. God's love depends upon nothing outside of himself, but upon his sovereign will and pleasure only. Christ did not die for us to cause God to love. God's love alone was the cause of Christ's propitiation. I want nothing but to know more experimentally the power of this love, more effectually influencing my heart and life. So he said, so this is what drove him. God in his grace poured out his love toward me. It's not that he saw that I was loving him, seeking after him, or that Christ somehow persuaded him to be loving. Even, you know, because sometimes you'll hear it almost that the cross is what, you know, really got God to love us. No, there wouldn't be a cross if God didn't love us. God loved us, therefore he sent his son. He demonstrates his love toward us in that while we're yet sinners, Christ dies for us. And so the majesty and the magnificence of God's love gives him the confidence and zeal to press on in life, whether it be getting through the day, preaching the gospel. So Thomas Charles of Bala, and I don't even know if it's pronounced Bala, but Thomas Charles is a hero, for one, because he didn't quit. Two, he was faithful to his Lord, whatever the consequences may be. Three, he saw the need, and he worked hard. Amen. And he worked hard to meet that need. And he was faithful to the end. Didn't live a long life either, but he was faithful in the ministry, and God used him in a mighty way, bringing revival to the northern part of Wales. Any questions, sir? Well, I thought he was from Wales, but then I did some checking just to be sure. He's actually born in England to Scottish parents. Now, David Martin Lloyd Jones is from Wales. And so he treasured, and that may have been the influence. You know, Ian Murray was an assistant to him for some years. And so he may have picked up the passion for, plus just God did mighty things in Wales. This during this season and later on, the Welsh revival, especially pouring out among the coal miners, and the stories told how the coal miners would come up out of the mines singing the great hymns of the faith. You know, Wales has a has had a great moving of God more than once. Who, Ian Murray? Yeah. Well, and being a publisher, and yes. Yeah. You know what? And one of the things that Ian Murray brings out is there are virtually no writings on Thomas Charles. Through history, there's one three-volume, very, very, very complete. on this day, he tied his shoes twice kind of biography. And then there's a shorter biography, which is a lot of selections from his diary. But, you know, thinking, well, we won't get into his relationship to his wife and courtship because, you know, that's not what you put into a spirit. That's not spiritual enough. So there's another one like that. There, he's mentioned in a set of volumes put out by Banner of Truth and this one. I mean, there is just not much has been given to really writing about this great hero. Now, I don't know how well he is known as much as Mary Jones is known. Again, her story is famous in Wales and elsewhere. Auld Lang Syne. Yeah.
The New Year's, what you always sing on New Year's. And I don't even know what that means. I don't know if it was originally a Christian thing or not. But
yeah. Yeah, it's another strange tune. What do those words even mean to us? Yeah. They are musical people. I often remember when Pastor Fineout from First Baptist was in Britain and he went to Wales and he visited a Welsh church. And he asked them, would you be so kind as to sing a Welsh hymn for me? And so they did. And he said it was the most moving experience, the harmony. And you know, because as you heard the singer here say, show them we're a singing nation. Now, just last night, we were at a ball game. And it was great evidence that we are not a singing nation. You know, it's just astounding. You know, we are not. We're the Welsh people are a singing people. And it was fascinating to me as I saw several clips in all kinds of contexts where they're singing this song. This is a song that really captures who they are. What a great song. Any other comments or questions on them? Any more of it than what, you know, as far as, I just to say that just, it's popularity, it's beauty, it's power, from William Williams, who was one of the guys who influenced. Matter of fact, towards the end of William's life, so Charles was born 15 years after the date I put for the Great Awakening. So he's kind of almost a second generation and nurtured by guys like John Newton and William Williams. So at the end of his life, William Williams writes to Thomas Charles and just really exhorts him the urgency of staying grounded in biblical truth, in doctrinal faithfulness. And so kind of as we're passing the baton here, keep God's people grounded in truth. And so that's the guy that writes, "Guide me, O great Jehovah." Interestingly, the way they sang it, I think, in the wedding is they changed the word to great redeemer. I think they changed because Jehovah, I thought they felt like maybe most people wouldn't know. So now, at least somewhere, if you ever bump into someone that mentions Thomas Charles, you might say, oh, of Bela? Oh, yes.